You're listening to another great podcast in the MyMac Podcasting Network.
Tech Fam Podcast number 515. I am Tim Robertson. That is David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hello.
It is, as we record this, December, technically December 8th, 2024. This month marks 20 years I've been podcasting.
Yeah, you know what? Did I mention this last time we spoke? I was at a thing a couple of weeks ago, and I told people that I've been podcasting for nearly 20 years. They were all extremely impressed.
It's, not big on tooting my own horn much, but it is still kind of an accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of people don't stick it out that long.
No. Well, that's the thing. When we get done recording, and he'll do this with you as well, Guy Searle is putting together a special 1,000th episode of the MyMac podcast. He's still a few episodes away, but he's putting all the pieces together and he's going to, you know, have a chat with all the major players that's, you know, been part of that show. Mm-hmm. And that was the show that I started back in December of 2004.
Yeah.
And so I've been thinking about history a little bit lately, and I thought, you know, there was some big shows when we started that, the MyMac podcast. I can't find one of those shows still publishing.
No, that's right. One. They're all gone. Yeah.
Almost from what I can tell, and I've done maybe 20 minutes worth of research. So if you don't count the ones that were a radio program that transitioned in as a podcast, which I don't, no. Because it was a radio show.
Yeah.
You had a built-in listener. You didn't start as a podcast from the ground up. So as a pure podcast, I think the MyMac podcast might be the oldest in the world at this point.
No, it's certainly definitely in the running. And there's probably, if there are any others that are of the same sort of age, there's probably, I would say, no more than three or four. Because
everyone I looked for that said, oh, this is the longest running podcast, stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. And unlike, you know, the YouTube and the TikTok generation nowadays, who basically stick at it because it earns them a lot of money, you know, your Linus and your Marcus Brownlee and people like that. Yeah. I mean, they do it because it earns them a good living. Yeah. We've never really earned a living off this. So we do it for the love of it. And I do find it interesting because I remember about 10 years ago when the idea of a podcast started to permeate outside of tech circles into public consciousness. And there was an awful lot of, you know, people going, a podcast? What's a podcast? And then there were people who kind of, you know, tried to explain it and all that sort of thing. It was still a bit of an oddity, but people were becoming aware of it. Now, I mean, you can't, certainly in Britain, you can't move for podcasts from pretty much every mainstream broadcaster and celebrity going. They all have their own podcasts and they basically doing the same thing we do, which is it's normally a couple of guys or a couple of girls or a mix of the two or three sitting around just talking about stuff. Yep. Most of them aren't doing stuff related to their day jobs. You know, there's a couple of famous comedians here in the UK who've got a very big podcast show where they talk about being parents. And obviously, you know, they're comedians, so they kind of make it funny. But it's basically them chatting, and there's quite a lot of those in the British celebrity circuit now. And then obviously the BBC does loads of effectively radio shows, but does them as podcasts.
Are they radio shows and that they're just using them?
Some of them are, but some of them are dedicated podcasts, but they're made in a radio studio with a producer and they're basically made like they would make a radio show. They just do them as podcasts and they don't tend to broadcast them. And then there's been a few, particularly on the BBC, they started doing some of the political people on the BBC started doing one for Brexit during the Brexit process called the Brexit Cast. And that has effectively transitioned the other way, which I find interesting. It went from being an audio 2 to 3 shows a week of about half an hour. And it's now effectively a TV and radio show. Which they do the same thing. And a lot of the news organisations started doing that now. So they're effectively doing the multi-format. They sit down in a room with a camera on and they talk to each other, but then they will transmit it as a broadcast show, but they'll also put it on as a podcast and transmit it on the radio.
It's amazing how far the industry has come since, well, for me, December 29th, 2004 was the very first one. I think it's still on our website, mymac.com. Nope. I mean, it's the page is there, but the file is missing, so I got to relink the file to it. But it's still in the wild out there, which is so long ago. It's kind of crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it really is interesting to see how much things have changed over just that 20 years, you know. I mean, just even the way we do this show, we couldn't do this show the way we do it now back then, because the you know, being able to talk over the internet wasn't anywhere near as easy as it is now, and it wasn't anywhere near as reliable as it is now.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, not even. It's night and day. The everything I had to jump through to start that first podcast is.
Well, yeah, so I mean, even though you were doing it with Chad and he was not far from you at the time.
Not initially, it was just me.
Yeah, but when you started doing it with a co-host, with Chad, you still went over his house to record it. Nowadays, you just wouldn't even think about that. You'd just say, just jump on a call, you know. But back then, that wasn't really reliable. It could work it, and we did it. I mean, I used to call in to speak to you guys, but... it wasn't reliable. We had all sorts of problems, and now it's much, much better. Still goes wrong occasionally.
Every now and then. Yeah.
Well, that's computers for you.
Well, yeah. It's. Let me see on it.
And certainly what I'm doing to you now, which is effectively I'm talking to you over an internet phone that's wirelessly connected to my recording equipment. Well, exactly. That would just like, you know, no, absolutely not. You know, you needed a couple of, you needed at least $1,000 computer to get it going.
I'm doing a search on my computer to see if I actually have the first podcast on my computer. I'm not sure if I do or not. Trying again. Maybe not.
I'm sure you've got it somewhere, but.
Oh, yeah, I've got it somewhere. It's on one of my external drives.
In fact, one of the things I've started working on, I bought a network attached storage device, an old one, in the last couple of weeks, and I'm starting to think hard about actually bringing all my stuff together into one place so that I can find it. I mean, I've got probably 10 worse worth of photos of my kids that are on devices that aren't plugged in and are sat on a shelf somewhere.
Here's the question then. Do you look at just a large ass, you know, 5 terabyte external drive, or do you start looking at something like a NAS?
No, I bought a NAS because I don't want to leave a computer running for it. So,
well, it's not just that though, because it will back itself up.
Yeah. So the NAS I bought, it's an old, out of date, obsolete thing from Netgear because I'm cheap. And because I am literally only going to treat it virtually as storage and streaming videos, so I don't need any of the modern features. So I just bought a cheap one. It came with 2-3 terabyte drives that mirror each other. And then what I'll do is I will occasionally plug in an external drive to that and take backups of it. And then I'll also configure the most important stuff, like the photos is the most important thing, really. I'll configure those to also be copied up to a cloud service like OneDrive or something, so that I've got multiple copies. Because remember, kids, if you don't have a file in 3 places, it doesn't exist.
Oh, that is true.
Yeah. But the idea is to try and centralize everything and just pick it up from the... You know, the amount of storage I've got lying around. I've got an old server downstairs from our old house that I've never fired up here, and that I know that's got photos on it. Hopefully they're not in an obsolete format like Aperture or something, but...
that does happen.
I know. I absolutely know. So, I'm going to be figuring that out over the next few months because I don't want to lose that stuff, you know. And as you get older, you become increasingly more conscious that when you're gone... A lot of that stuff might disappear with you if you're not careful. You know, it's all, nobody else is going to know where it is or how to get it or even that it ever existed.
I hope some of this stuff for me disappears. I mean, my kids are not, could you imagine?
Well, let's face it. And when we think about leaving this stuff for our kids, the kids are never going to look at it.
No.
But it just makes us feel
better.
Well,
they may when they get to be our age or older and they get nostalgic and they're like, oh, I would like to go back and let, you know, well, they can, but I don't know why they would want to.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to hear my dad talking about video games from, you know, 2014. Yay.
Yeah.
It's been kind of an interesting week in tech. You know, we just got done with Thanksgiving here in the U.S.
You know, I was going to say that. I mean, one of the reasons we didn't record last week is that we didn't have very much to talk about. And well, that's...
Every tech thing was about the sale.
Exactly. And it drove me mad. And it's and it annoys me more, even more here, because we don't do Thanksgiving. And yet, because of that, because we don't really understand Thanksgiving, but we've adopted Black Friday. Black Friday has been going on here for about 3 weeks.
Yeah, it is here too. And it doesn't mean anything. What bothers me more than anything, honestly, is that the sales were shit.
Yeah.
They just were. There was no great sales.
Well, because why would you? Because it's coming up to Christmas and everyone's buying gifts. So the big scam of Black Friday is to claim something is discounted because you put a fictional price it's never been on at. And you say, oh, it's not $500 anymore. Now it's $350. And it's just like, yeah, but nobody ever paid $500 for it. That's the big scam of Black Friday. And so, yeah, it's very rare for you to find actual deals because, of course, the real deals are going when they want to shift stock after Christmas, not before. So, yeah, Black Friday is a bit... I know in America it was about clearing out inventory so you could stock up for Christmas, but we don't do that here. So certainly here it's just a waste of time. And some of the stuff... You know, when I get a Black Friday deal for a restaurant, I just think, what? What? You know?
Yeah.
And of course, then they did Cyber Monday as well, which... And I got Cyber Monday... deal for another restaurant, which was crazy. And then, of course, you go to the tech sites and they are, they're full of the ads. Effectively, you know, let's get some affiliate link money, sweet affiliate link money coming in. So they're advertising stuff that's either been promoted to them or that they want to get a cut of. And the worst thing is I've noticed this the last couple of years, is you get these faux articles from all of them, which basically says, the headline is, I review laptops for a living, and these are the ones you should buy this Black Friday. And it just basically, it's just garbage. It's garbage. Absolute garbage, because it's not real recommendations.
Because if you click the link, oh look, it's an affiliate link. What bothers me is Ars Technica sometimes does it, but really Engadget and The Verge and all the big tech sites. Lowest price we've ever seen on. I'm so sick of that. It's like, and you're like, oh, what's the big sale? Oh, it's $32 off.
And it used to be that they would put those in one or two articles, but now no, everything is an individual, and you've got to try and pick out. And basically I just gave up reading the internet for the last couple of weeks because it was so hard to get any content through all the advertising.
And that's all it is. And let's back up a second. I had to go buy some birthday presents for Cole.
Yep.
His birthday was a couple days ago. So I'd bought him some things and it was delivered from Amazon. But one of the PS5 controllers has dripped. Now, I could take it apart and probably fix it, but I'm not going to do that. So I went out to Best Buy and got him a video game, Final Fantasy Remix or something, and that controller.
Yeah.
It was at Best Buy, so what the heck? I could drive on the way home, pick it up, and, you know,
yeah.
Plus, we had to get a new countertop ice maker there. So,
okay.
It was a whole thing that I had to do. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but I was tired. And it was after work and it still felt like a big thing. So, I get home or I get to Best Buy to pick it up because I bought it online. I'm just going to go in and grab it, right?
Yep. Or so you think.
Now, this is post. Oh, no, it was easy.
Yeah.
This is post Black Friday. Mm-hmm. And I had seen a TikTok of another. It wasn't Best Buy, but it was somebody that had been advertising their big TV sale. Now, back in the day, David, we remember the videos of Black Friday where people would rush in trying to grab these TVs. And it was such a good
because
deal.
Because they would have one or two at literally a stupid price to try and generate that buzz.
But it was still a new thing. These flat screen TVs you could put on your wall that only weighed, you know, mm-hmm. 15 pounds. Now they weigh, 2 pounds. And everybody has a big TV now.
Yeah.
No one's breaking into your house to see your TV. No. They don't care.
Only the stupid thieves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because they're like, it's just a big flat screen. Who cares anymore? Yeah. Because they're a dime a dozen. But someone forgot to tell the retailers this. So I seen these videos of another retailer that had all these TVs in after Black Friday. And they talked to someone in the store, and literally two people had come in on Black Friday and bought a TV.
Yeah.
So I go into Best Buy, and it's post Black Friday, and the entire store is littered with nothing but boxes of TV. Anywhere they can put a box with the TV in it,
yep.
It's everywhere. It's by the washing machines. It's by everywhere.
Yeah.
Nobody went to our Best Buy to buy a TV.
No.
Why? Because A, it wasn't good sales. They were lying about pricing. There's a store here in the U.S. called Kohl's that's really bad about it. They'll say, hey, look, new low price for Black Friday, $49.99. You peel off the sticker, it was $39.99 a week before.
Yeah.
So they're just lying. And thanks to TikTok and YouTube and whatever, everybody knows that they're lying now. So they can't get away with it. They still try, but unless you're 80 and just don't know, it's a good deal. And B, commodities... or TVs are just a commodity product now to a point that they've never been before.
Yeah.
They're no longer a luxury thing. Everybody has a big screen TV.
Yeah. And everybody. Even the lousy ones look okay.
They look fine. And when it breaks, you don't fix it anymore. You just go buy another TV
which is the only time.
You can get a 55 inch 4K TV. $150, $200
Yeah, the only problem I have with that is that they're being subsidized by the fact they're spying on everything you do, which I have a
whole different matter entirely.
But
if you just look at what's available in the stores post Black Friday, it's a joke because nobody cared.
Yeah.
Now, do you blame rampant 24/7 consumerism? Do you blame Amazon? Or is it just the fact that we're at the point now that people buy what they need when they need it? They're not waiting to Black Friday.
I think that's it. I mean, there are people who wait for Black Friday because they're hoping to get a discount of some description. But the reality, I think, for many people, not everybody, and let's be honest, not everybody can afford to go to Best Buy and buy even a cheap TV. But for many people, you don't wait for a sale on something like that, because they're not really the sort of thing, unless you've got a lot of money, there are still people who go out and spend thousands of dollars on those, massive 75 inch OLED super HD 8K devices. And then, they mount them on the wall like it's a cinema, but most people don't do that. Most people buy a new TV when they need a new TV. Now, TVs don't last as long as they used to. They crap out after about 5-6 years nowadays, in my experience. The backlight goes,
I'd agree.
Or that some of the electronics goes, and all of a sudden you start getting blocky pictures or something like that. Or the remote stops working, and it's because it's the receiver in the TV.
Whatever the reason is,
at that point you just go, okay, time to get a new TV. And
the first thing you say is, okay, about what size? Well, I kind of want about the same size, maybe a little bit bigger.
So yeah,
more than 60 inch.
I think that's what most people do. They look at what they have and go, oh, I could get 5 more inches for the same money.
And then they say, well, how much do I want to spend?
Yeah.
Well, I think I want to tap out maybe, I don't think I want to spend more than like $350.
Yeah.
So then they go to Amazon or here in the US, Best Buy or Walmart. And they probably go to all three or maybe a couple other ones too. And that's what they search for. TVs over this size, under this price. And that's what they're going to buy.
People who maybe do video games and that sort of stuff sometimes will go, oh, I want one with lots of HDMI ports.
240 megahertz.
No, well, 8K. But I think more often that people will go, well, I've got three or four things connected to it. I've got a set-top box. I've got a PlayStation. I've got a Switch. And I need to make sure I've got enough HDMI sockets for all that. Yeah, so that is, to me, is probably the most...
But that's probably secondary.
Yeah, but that's probably the most technical thing people think about, because all of the TVs are kind of the same. Now, you know, they all do 4K. They all have, in the UK, they all have the same digital services in. You know, most of them support the free over-the-air stuff that we have here. I know you don't have quite the same stuff in the US, but here we've got a kind of standardized digital television system that's got all the, you know, it's got probably about 70 channels on, and they're all kind of the same. You know, it's all the regular transmitting stations here, and then a whole load of other ones from, you know, Quest and Disney and Discovery are a big one and things like that. And then each of the main broadcasters has probably about 10, 15 different channels. And then some HD variants. And all the TVs support all of that. And they all have built-in Net stuff, so you can get Netflix and Apple TV and Disney Plus and Amazon and all that sort of thing. That's all built into all the TVs. They're all the same. You know, really is very little in it.
And going to the store to look at them makes no difference anymore.
No, it never really did, because the store always adjusts the TVs in such a way that they don't look anything like they look when they're at home. You know, they whack the brightness up and they turn all the contrast up to full, and then they whack the volume up to make them sound louder. And then there's 15 of those all in a row next to each other. There's no way you can do proper comparisons there.
No. Yeah. And the internet is woefully inadequate. Well, there's some places like Tom's Guide and stuff like that does a pretty good job. But
yeah,
you have to really, really search to figure out who's giving you good information, not based on their affiliate links.
Yeah.
And that's kind of with everything, though.
Yep.
It really is. I mean, I wanted to replace a really nice pair of fingernail clippers that I had. They broke. I really liked them, and I spent probably way more time than most people would. I spent about 20 minutes, maybe a half hour, going through some, and then I finally picked a pair, which were, they weren't expensive or anything. They're like $30. But still $30.
Were they the Japanese ones?
Yes.
I have from that same. It's the ones that if you do a bit of research, everyone eventually recommends, and they say, yeah.
And I kept coming across it.
Yeah.
So I just bought it. They're really, really sharp. They open pretty good. I mean, it's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
But it took me about a half hour. Now, is that a wasted half hour? I don't think so. But you do have to spend a little bit of time. If you just do a quick Google search, forget about it.
Yeah.
It's not going to work. Let's talk about some of the stuff that we've got in the show notes here, David. The big thing to me, there's two of them. Let's start with Intel.
Yeah.
Intel's CEO suddenly retired. Well,
he was fired.
He was fired.
It was,
they gave him a choice.
It was, guess what, guy, you're gone tomorrow. Do you want to retire today or do you want to be fired tomorrow? And he said, I'm going to retire. So this is, you know, I feel sorry for Pat Gelsinger.
I don't.
Well, I do. And I'll explain why. First of all, he started his career at Intel. He worked there for 25 years. He then left and he was the CEO of VMware for a while. And as you know, he used to go to the VMware show. So I've heard this guy speak quite a lot over quite a few years. And he always seemed to be pretty clued up about what had to happen and where his company was going. He came across as somebody who wasn't, you know, he wasn't like an Elon Musk or a Sam Altman or some of these guys or even worse, you know, those guys bullshit. And then you get the guys like Satya Nadella and the guy at Google, Sundar Pichai, who basically everything they say is so vague, it doesn't mean anything. He wasn't like that. He was, you know, pretty straight. I mean, he had an engineering background. He was pretty straight down the line and he was pretty direct about what was going to happen, what he thought had to happen, what he thought the trends were. I always found him interesting to speak. Now, he was lured back to Intel because they approached him as an ex-CTO and said, look, you know, this is about 5-6 years ago. We're in trouble here. We've made some mistakes and we need to turn the company around. Do you have any ideas? And he put forward this pretty bold idea. He said, what you need to do is get out of the chip design business and get into the chip manufacturing business, because people will always need to manufacture chips and they don't necessarily need to be your chips. And they signed on for that. And then they said, would you like to be CEO and come back and actually do that? And he said, he was very careful. He said, well, look, I'm only going to do that if you're going to back me, because this is going to be really expensive. It's going to take some time. And in the meantime, the company's got to keep going. And I don't want, you 2 years down the line to turn around and say, oh, it's not, the stockholders don't like it, and boot me out. He actually went and individually spoke to everybody on the board and got their personal backing for this. Now, it's taken a little bit longer than he thought, but here we are. I think it's 4.5, 5 years later, and all of a sudden the board has decided the shareholders don't like it, so they got rid of him. The problem is they are in the middle of this transition and they haven't pulled it off yet. And so they're now in a far worse position than they were when they brought him on board. And, you know, he's done exactly what he said he would do, which they backed him for.
It took longer
for reasons. But nevertheless, it's a very difficult thing to do. He secured huge funding from the US government to do it, because part of the deal is to try and bring chip manufacturer away from Taiwan and TSMC and bring it back into the US. And that's what he's been trying to do. It's one of the reasons it's taken longer, because guess what? You know, when you're not in in the Far East, it's more difficult to bring people along with you, because people have different interests and labor relations come into it. And it's all more expensive because our costs are high here. And, you know, local zoning boards don't like the idea you're going to build a chip fab in their backyard. There's been lots of problems, but I do feel sorry for him, because I think he's taken the blame for mistakes Intel made before he came along that are still hanging over them. And you know, he's been, don't get me wrong, I'm sure he's not financially put out by this, but you know, effectively he's had to end his career on a low by being effectively fired for doing what he said he was going to do. Your counterpoint?
No, I agree with it, except it did take longer than he thought it was going to. And they've fallen so far behind the rest of the industry. And Intel, a long time ago, became more about marketing than engineering prowess, which is where I think they made their biggest mistake. They just kept doing the same thing over and over with small iterations, rather than jumping ahead of where everybody, you and I, could see where the developing trends were.
Well,
And they just got caught flat-footed.
I think what happened is everybody was saying, you know, when the rise of mobile, which all run on ARM chips, everyone said, look, this is the future of computing. Yeah. And there's been a couple of false dawns. Remember when the iPad was the future of computing, until it wasn't? And obviously, you know...
But it was still mobile.
Yeah, it was still mobile. And those devices have just gotten better and better and better. And the phones have gotten better and better and better. And really,
anybody that's in the tech world knew that was going to happen. We all knew and portable computing was the future, the present at the time,
about,
and the future.
About six.
They completely missed the boat.
Yeah, about 6 years ago, when the benchmarks for each year of the iPhone started beating Intel laptops, that was when Intel should have said, you know what, one day somebody's going to take one of those chips and put it in a PC, and it's going to be really good, and they're going to eat our lunch. Now,
but they didn't. Nobody at Intel did that.
And, no, they didn't. You know, they didn't do it, and they let somebody else do it. And then and then Apple came along and surprise, ate their lunch.
We'll get to that in a second. But the point that companies started abandoning their products for their rivals that were moving ahead with newer, better architecture.
Yeah.
They're building a huge chip manufacturing down in Ohio. And we're 3 years into it now, and nothing's really happened. And that's also on Intel. You know, if they don't get their stuff together really, really quickly here, I think they're going to get acquired by someone, and they're going to become, you know, an also-ran.
Yeah. Basically, they're in the same position that Boeing have been, where they abandoned their core business of engineering and became all about marketing. And unfortunately, Intel for many years, well before Gelsinger came along, has been propped up by being effectively anti-competitive. They've been doing the sort of stuff that Microsoft were doing and punished for many years ago. They've been paying people to use their chips. They've been saying, you use our chips, then you can't use anybody else's in the same product line. If you take AMD's chips or something like that, we might all of a sudden move you down the priority list for the latest developments. They've been doing all of that. And in the meantime, their products have been getting worse and worse and worse. They've come up with some great ideas. They were the ones who came up with the idea of, well, let's double the processor cores and increase the performance. When they did that, nobody else was doing that. And they pulled it off. And for that period from probably about 2006, 2007.
Intel, 18 years ago.
Yeah, so. Well, that's right. But for that period up until about
10 years ago.
Yeah, up until about 10 years ago, they were absolutely hitting it out of the park. And even Apple famously decided to go down Intel because their chips were better. But then they just stagnated and they was piling more stuff on. There were issues, there were problems. And the real issue was that because they were just increasing die size to get more performance, their chips were becoming less and less power efficient just at the time when everybody wanted better battery life.
Yeah.
And it was, everybody always knew that if you bought an Intel laptop, yeah, you were going to get 6 to 8 hours of battery life. That was the best they could ever do.
Yeah. And it was going to run hot.
And it was going to run hot. Yeah. And every time you did anything, the fans would spin up.
The fans kicks on.
Yeah. You know, it would run hot. If you played a game, it would run even hotter. If you did anything graphical, it would run even hotter. And it was just like, you know, people they thought we want better than this. And Intel just churning out the same thing.
Yeah. Do you think Intel is going to be acquired by someone? Do you think they're going to survive this? What do you think?
I don't know.
If they go to manufacturing, that becomes their thing. I think it saves them as a brand. But do you think Intel really survives? I mean, they're huge companies still.
Yeah, look, they've still got a huge market, and I don't think the rest of the industry would want to pivot away from Intel overnight. As good as the latest ARM chips are. Certainly, you know, and Qualcomm's made a splash in the last 18 months or so with these. They finally got processors that are, they're in the ball. The Snapdragon Elites. They're not as good as Apple's processors, but they're at least in the same kind of, they're on the same, kind of ballpark. So, but the problem is some of the issues with those processors still remain in terms of compatibility, and most of the software that people run out there on Windows is designed to run on an Intel chip. You can run it in emulation on those chips, but it doesn't run as well, and some things just don't work at all. So I don't think the industry is ready to pivot completely to ARM today. So Intel has some runway for that, but the issue they've got is in servers, none of those things apply, because in servers, everything can run on ARM. Because it's all virtualized away from x86. It can run you can run in Linux that can be natively compiled for ARM. And frankly, servers is the big business. It's desktop computers is a tiny business nowadays for anybody, you know, and it's been in decline for the last 6-7 years. I think since before the pandemic, people were buying less and less PCs. Because you know what? A lot of people do stuff just on a mobile device like a phone now. They don't need a computer like they used to. And really, and you and I have said this before, you look at today's computers from anything you buy that's in the last 6 years or something like that is so powerful compared to what we had before. It can do 90% of what everybody wants to do. Because most people just want to browse the web, do a bit of writing, bit of email, bit of, maybe a bit of light photo editing and everything. The part of the problem is...
Your phone can do that.
Yeah, the part of the problem, and the cloud can also do it. And in the next few years, AI will be able to do a lot of that for you without you having to do any of it at all. So the reality is that the demand for powerful, powerful processors is not really there. You know, and even Apple... They keep developing faster processors, but they're very careful to keep the power consumption and the power performance of these laptops the same. So you buy an M4 MacBook Pro today, and it still has that great battery life that the M1 MacBook had. It just runs a little bit faster. And I believe, I've not tried one myself, but I believe the M4s is the first time that they've actually made a real performance increase. The M1, M2, M3 was all like little steps. M4 is meant to be...
Yeah, M4 is a big increase.
It is a big increase, you know. And that's the way Intel used to do it, is they used to have a few incremental steps and then they'd have a big architecture change. But the problem is it's all about brand perception now. And once you get a perception in the market that you're on... you're beleaguered, Apple's been there, then it can be very difficult to counter that. And Intel's got some real problems. I suspect what will happen is that they will split into a foundry manufacturing business and then the chip design business. And the chip design business might be acquired by somebody. But, they won't be the force they were. And it's probably a good thing, to be honest, because they were so big that they were anti-competitive. And that's a bad thing.
Speaking of anti-competitive, for Mac users, the big competitor to Photoshop for the last few years anyways, I'd say maybe the last 6 or 7 years, has been Pixelmator.
Yeah.
Pixelmator is a great photo editing tool. It really is.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Now, I use Photoshop, but I also use Pixelmator. I have both. The big news over the last couple of weeks was that Apple acquired Pixelmator.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I really liked Pixelmator as a product, and I wonder what Apple's going to do with it. I'm like, where does this fit in with what Apple does? I don't know. What do you think?
I wasn't pleased when I heard this, because typically what tends to happen is either it's an acqui-hire and the people who make Pixelmator disappear into Apple and the product just dies, which happens to a lot of internal Apple stuff, to be honest. Alternatively, they fold the technology into the software, into Photos or something like that, and the product dies. Alternatively, the third thing is it just continues on, but in a typical Apple fashion, it doesn't get the resources it needs to move forward and dies on the vine. So in all in all three of those scenarios, it doesn't look good for Pixelmator, the piece of software. The most unlikely thing is that it becomes Apple Pixelmator and it gets real resources and it gets turned into a true alternative or a pro version of Apple Photos. That is the one we'd like to see happen. It's the one that I think is least likely to happen. And even if it does happen, the problem is that, you know, Apple will make a big splash about Apple Pixelmator version 1.0, and then they'll not pay any attention to it after they've launched it, because that's what they often do. And then it dies on the vine. So I've got to be honest, having been a Pixelmator user, I also use Pixelmator Photo, which is a very light version. It's like if you married Pixelmator and Lightroom together into the same thing, and it's nowhere near as powerful as Lightroom, but it's much simpler, and it was really good for managing photos, and because it integrated properly with the Photos library, it worked directly with it. It was a very nice complement to Photos, and I tended to use it most of the time. I've stopped using them now, and I actually, one Black Friday sale I did take advantage of was a discount on the photo plan for Lightroom, and I've gone back to Lightroom because
Lightroom's still the best.
It is, and it's much more complicated. But the thing is, for me, is that I know that Lightroom will be there next year.
Yeah, well, there is that. Yeah,
you know, and that's really the thing. I'm trying to get. You know, I talked a few weeks ago about playing with cameras, and we did that show about comparing the iPhone and everything. I'm trying to get more into my photography now, and I need a decent program to store my photos in and manage them in. And I just, Photos is not powerful enough, and I'm not going to stick with Pixelmator Photos. Because I honestly think it's
going to die eventually. No question. It's going to become something else. And,
you know, and one of the advantages, everyone hates on Adobe for the subscription model, but one of the advantages of the subscription model is it keeps the software there, because, you know, while they're getting the revenue from the subscription, you know, they're going to continue to invest in it. And actually the Black Friday deal for the Lightroom package, which I think gives you Lightroom and Photoshop and 20 gig of storage in their cloud. Yeah. It was like 40% off for a year's subscription. It was a little bit of a no-brainer. I think I paid about £65-70 for a year, which for programs like Lightroom and Photoshop really is a bargain.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah.
They are the pro level products.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's nothing else. But Apple acquiring Pixelmator kind of made me think back to some of their biggest acquisitions. And the two that I came up with, and I think these are probably Pixelmator doesn't rate in the top 10 so far, but the top two acquisitions that Apple has done in the past that had the biggest impact on the company. Number one, when they spent $400 million for Next.
Well,
that was a huge, huge change for Apple.
Well, literally say, I mean, no hyperbole, save the company.
Yes.
They didn't know it at the time.
Did it bring Steve Jobs? No, they kind of did, I think. Not only did it bring Steve Jobs back into the fold, and, you know, Gil Emilio basically spent $400 million of Apple's money for his replacement. Apple was struggling so bad with the Mac OS, and this is pre-iPod, this is pre-phone, this is pre-everything. It was all about the Mac.
Yep.
And Apple's internal team was really struggling coming up with a next-generation operating system.
Hadn't they tried twice already? They had Pink, and then they had Rhapsody. Yeah. And those were both attempts to basically modernize Mac OS into something that was, you know,
protected memory.
Proper multitasking rather than cooperative multitasking.
Because if you had an app crash your Mac, it crashed the entire Mac. Yeah. Everything is dead.
Yeah.
Whereas now, if Photoshop crashes, you just force quit it and relaunch and you're good to go.
Yeah, and that architecture that Next brought in and basically was turned into Mac OS X literally saved the company because you could not build all of the products that come since then when people have been going, oh, the iPad is going to, or the iPhone's going to replace the Mac, they're going to turn the Mac into a touch iPad with a keyboard and all of this sort of thing, is people forget you can't build any of the stuff that Apple sells without having a Mac.
The base cores of these systems are still all based off Mac OS X, which is Next.
Yeah. I do wonder nowadays how much OS X is left inside iOS.
I think more than you might think.
Well, maybe. But the point is because of that, you still need a Mac to develop for all of these. Yep. And that's never going to change. You can't develop these applications and the hardware and software combinations on an iPad or an iPhone. And so the Mac is always going to have that place. It's always going to be underpin the entire Apple ecosystem. And that could not have happened with OS X.
And then the next one
basically is this, save the company for the second time, I think, bearing in mind what we've just talked about it with Intel.
Yep. $278 million and they bought PA Semi.
Yeah.
And that's a semiconductor company. And this is where we get the M1 chips.
Yeah. Well, the A chips. The yeah. Yeah. These guys.
That's where they started.
Yeah. These guys have basically taken the ARM architecture and made it sing. Because ARM was around for a long time. I mean, a long time before that. And ARM itself is.
PA Semi was the one that was really taken to another level. And Apple recognized that, realized that they had to get off of Intel. Not only for the phones, but for the computers too.
Yeah. Well, that's the magic. I mean, and this is where nobody saw this coming. Even though everybody was saying, well, it's obvious, isn't it? These chips are so powerful, you've got to put them in the computer. And everyone was going, no, you couldn't. What about compatibility? There was all these reasons why it was hard to do. And Apple's engineers from PA Semi said, yeah, it's hard to do, but you know what? This is the part of the advantage you have if you own the whole widget, is they were basically able to say to the software developers, say, we will give you a chip that will run rings around what you have today, and all you have to do is make your software work on it. And Apple's software engineers went, yeah, okay. Well, they were told, yeah, okay. And I'm sure there was some of them who thought that it would never work, and you would never be able to get a Mac that ran well on an ARM chip as good as the Intel ones did. And then they've just come out and done it. And not only have they done it, when did the M1 come out? Was it 2020? Within 4 years, they've continued to develop that architecture into something that is quite literally the market leader.
That's what people tend to forget, is this is not, an acquisition way, way in the past. This is, in tech world, this is relatively recent. And here we are just 4 years in, and it's completely changed everything about Apple's business.
Yeah. And for all the people saying, oh, well, Qualcomm and Intel and everything can catch up, they're not. Qualcomm's got real problems at the moment because they're in a legal fight with ARM. Because Qualcomm did what Apple did. They acquired a company called Nuvia, who had developed M-like chips for PCs. That's what they were working on. And Qualcomm acquired them because they said, look, our own internal chips, the phone chips, they work okay in a laptop, but they're not really stellar. They're not as good as an Intel chip. We need something that's better than an Intel chip. NUVIA said, yeah, we can do that. So they acquired them. But Qualcomm have turned around and said, well, NUVIA's licenses were for NUVIA. They weren't for Qualcomm. Just because you acquired them, that doesn't mean you can use them. And now they're in a big legal fight. And there is a serious risk that Qualcomm's PC class chips could be stopped being manufactured by court. And in that case, you know, Qualcomm's dead. In fact, if that happens, that might be Intel's lifeline.
That could, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So it just made me think of those acquisitions. And I think maybe someday we'll go into really an in-depth on some of these. Somebody I'd like to get on the show and talk about some of these would be Owen Rubin, who has officially retired and would like to do the show with us again. But he's in California, and it's like 4:30 in the morning when we record for him. So we'll see. But he wants to get back on the show, and I told him anytime he would like to.
Yeah.
What's going on with the picture that we used for this episode?
So this is from a company we've talked about before called Retro Games. And this is their latest product. These are the guys who did the C64 Mini. I think you've got one. Yeah, it's a little tiny half-size Commodore 64 that runs C64 emulation. And you can plug a USB drive into it. It comes with 64 games, you know, a good mix of the classic games for the C64. Comes with
a decent little system.
Yeah, it's nice. And then they did a maxi version with the full keyboard, which I have and is gorgeous. And then they did an Amiga version. And last year they did an Atari 400. Both of those were kind of not full size. They were shrunk down ones that basically ran with the joystick and everything. So they've got a product for this year. And this is the one I've kind of been waiting for, because this is their version of the Spectrum,
which is big in the UK and was nothing in the US.
It was nothing in the US, but still hugely influential, because most people don't realize about the Spectrum. So the Spectrum was an 8-bit Z80 based computer, very similar to the Commodore 64. But what Sinclair, the guy who designed these, did is he wanted to build, and it's a very British thing to do, he wanted to build a computer that, and remember, this is the 80s when, you know, globalization hadn't happened. The actual standard of living in the UK was substantially less than it was in the US at the time, and we had less money. He wanted to build affordable home computers for British people. And so he engineered these things down to a price. And the ZX Spectrum, it was a 16-bit color system. It had, for the time, pretty good graphics. But it was a third of the price of a Commodore 64. And that meant it was huge here. And because it was so big, it meant that when the big video game crash of the early 80s happened, it didn't happen here. Because people had stopped playing console video games by 1984, 1985. They were all playing games on Spectrums. Yeah. And a very high proportion of the big games developers today are either populated by or led by British people who cut their teeth writing games in their back rooms for their Spectrum. And so it's a huge, basically there would be no modern video game industry without the Spectrum. It's a hugely important system, even though outside the UK and Europe, not a lot of people have ever played with one. What I love about what they've done here is that they have literally recreated the original Spectrum. It's exactly the same case. It has the same rubber style cheap keyboard, but it was kind of nice. I mean, it was very clever for that. All of the thing about these machines was they were incredibly cleverly engineered to keep the cost down. Back in the day, these only connected to a television. They had no monitor ports on them. You had to use an RF modulator to connect them to a TV. They came with no... I think they had an expansion port on, but nothing else. So there was no joysticks. There was just the video out. There was no storage apart from cassette tape. But the thing is, it was cheap. It was £130, £125, I think it actually was, which was the equivalent of maybe $300 back then.
Yeah. It was affordable.
It was affordable. And because it was affordable, 1.5 million people bought the damn things. And that meant it was a huge market. And, you know, you look at what this system's got on it, some of the games, they are actually quite sophisticated considering how limited the machine is. And what I like about what Retro Games has done here is that obviously it's an emulator. So even though it's in the same case, with the same keyboard, and you can actually run the original operating system on it, so you can even load type in basic games from a listing if you want to. Yeah, they've loaded it with games. It's still got four USB ports. You can put your own games on via USB stick. You can plug a joystick. Sorry. You can plug a joystick in if you want, but it doesn't come with a joystick. You were meant to play on the keyboard because most of the games back in the day, they knew you had to buy an expansion system interface if you wanted a joystick. So most people didn't have them. They actually played on the keyboard.
Yeah, well, most of the games back then for the system was designed for the lowest common denominator.
Exactly,
which is,
yeah.
They have a Spectrum. They probably don't have a joystick.
And I've been through all the games on it. Most of them have joystick options because there was a manufacturer who did an add-on called Kempston, and they did a thing that plugged in the back and let you plug in an Atari joystick, and that was hugely successful. So most of the games also support an Atari joystick via the Kempston interface, and that's all of that supported too. So, it's really good. It's quite affordable. It's about £90, I think, which is not far away. Not far away from the original price of the Spectrum, but obviously it's worth a lot less nowadays. I think they're going to sell a ton of these in the UK because plenty of us have nostalgia. I never actually had a Spectrum. I had the previous...
Really? I would have thought you would have had one.
Well, I had the ZX81, which was the previous machine, which was far inferior to the Spectrum. It was only black and white. It only had 1 kilobyte of memory as standard. And it had a flat membrane keyboard that was pretty crappy. But the thing is, once I had that, my dad said, well, you've got a computer. So he wasn't interested in buying another one, especially when all he ever heard about people doing it is playing games. And my father thought that a computer should be for more intellectual pursuits than that. So right. I never had a Spectrum, and actually when I did get a new computer, I went straight to the Amiga, so which was a massive step change.
So we have more to talk about, but we're going to push this to the next episode.
Yeah.
By the end of the year.
Yeah.
So, but I want to end with this. I don't know if you saw this or not, but I thought it was pretty funny. I get free stuff.
Yep.
And, I'll click something. And I was looking at a way to put CarPlay into a car that doesn't have either audio input or USB.
Right.
And this popped out, but it's one of those screens that you can put in there and you can connect to it wirelessly or plug in. But this particular one doesn't look like it even transmits over FM. So it's just basically its own speakers, which sucks.
Right.
So It's for navigation, maybe, but that's a kind of it. I mean, it's so, when you scroll down on an Amazon page, they'll have all these, advertising pictures.
Yep.
And it says easy to install. And so the fourth one cracked me up. There's five of them, but number one, no need to disassemble the car, which is
always a plus.
Kind of a good thing. I don't want to have to. Yep. Number two, cigarette lighter plug and play. Okay. We don't really call it a cigarette lighter
anymore.
Yeah, and I think they mean the plug, not the actual cigarette lighter, because that doesn't do anything. It get hot.
Yeah, that's sucking. Yeah.
No, number three, obviously, this is not a Western company that wrote these.
Yeah.
Number three, fit all cars. Okay. Yeah. I guess so. I'm going to skip number four. And the last one is first magnetic suction function. Magnetic suction function.
Suction function.
But here's the fourth one, and this is why I posted it. And my caption for it was good news for women of the world. It says, women can also complete the instructions by themselves.
Yeah, oh. So simple. Even your wife can fit it.
Even a woman can do it.
Jeez.
I was just like, did they really put that there? Holy moly. How tone deaf could you be?
Dearie me. You get a lot of this from foreign cultures,
Melissa and Melissa should talk about this on the Geekier Show.
Oh, I think they should buy one and actually see how easy it is to install. The problem is, they say their claim to fame is that women can follow the instructions. Does that mean that women can understand the Chinglish better than we can? Because you know those instructions will be written as bad as those 5 points will be.
100%. So bad. In fact, one of the reviews is the instructions are nonsensical.
Of course. Of course they are.
They said it was actually fairly simple to do, but the instructions themselves are terrible. So
because, well, look, the reality is the people who write the instructions write them in Chinese and then they have to translate them using English. And it's like you and I writing something in English and trying to translate it to German or French. It's just like we're typing each word into Google Translate and just sticking it down, you know?
Exactly. So funny. Anyways, we're going to wrap up the show. We've got more, but we'll save it. David, as always, a pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully we get Owen on here pretty soon.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And we'd love to get feedback from you guys. The show at techfanpodcast.com. Of course, you can go to TechFanPodcast or MyMac.com and leave a message in the show notes. And we're on all the social media platforms, so you can find us there. David, I'll see you next week for Geeks Pub.
See you then.